May I introduce to you our next presenter, who is Dr. Joa Gomez Ferreira, who is a professor in environmental engineering at the Faculty of Sciences and Technology of the New University of Lisbon, Portugal, and currently on the board of IMAR, that is Institute of Marine Research. He is coordinating the modeling component of 12 European research projects over the last 15 years, published over 40 papers in peer-reviewed journals, and is the author of the EcoWind 2000 Ecological Modeling Package and the Farm Carrying Capacity Model. He's going to make a presentation on progressing aquaculture through virtual technology using novel management and decision-making tools. May I introduce to you Dr. Joa Gomez Ferreira. Thank you.
Sabadika, good morning. National and international representatives, colleagues, ladies and gentlemen, it's an absolute privilege to be here. I think that any event that happens once every 10 years has to be classified as landmark. Maybe in this case it would be more appropriate to classify it as watermark, I'm not sure. But in any case, just sitting where you are now and listening to the lectures we've had over the last few days would be an enormous experience for me. The fact that I'm up here addressing you on this topic is a real honor, and it's also a huge responsibility. I have to thank FAO for trusting me to do this, and in particular to thank Dr. Aguilar Manjares, because that was the engine that started all this procedure. Now, you'll see that this topic that I'm speaking on has got rather a complex and lengthy description. The subject itself is also reasonably complicated, and so when we saw the name of the topic that we were supposed to produce a thematic review on, we digested it fairly rapidly to virtual tools for aquaculture, and after that we metabolized it to VITAL, because that seemed like a quicker way to be able to deal with this. Otherwise we'd spend most of the time actually saying the name. So I hope to persuade you through the next 30 minutes that it is in fact a vital area. There's been remarkably little said about computing in this conference. There are only four posters that address computing-related subjects. None of them won the prize. Since I come from the days of log tables and slide rules, and I'm constantly amazed by the way everything has changed, I really do think that we need to pay a lot more attention to this side of things. Nothing is done single-handed these days. Not even the person who wins the 100 meters at the Olympics is actually a one-person activity. There's a big team behind it. So I have a lot of people. There are 12 of us to acknowledge on this, from institutes, from universities, from various parts of the world, all of them leading experts in areas related to virtual technologies. I'm going to go through this in the order roughly that we have the report structured. I'll tell you a little bit about the topics and objectives and definitions, then go on to data acquisition, follow that with a review of types and objectives of virtual technologies, and then get to, I think, what would interest people more as end users, as managers, which is the move from technologies to tools that people can use. Then a few words about novel management. We have seven case studies in the review. We tried to select those to be as wide-ranging as possible. I will focus very briefly, because time is very limited, on four of those, and then finish off with some points about emerging issues and the way forward, and that will probably form the focus of the discussion that we will subsequently have. So, some quick words on objectives. The Bangkok Declaration, we've spoken about it extensively this week, does not explicitly contemplate virtual technologies, but implicitly there are a number of aspects that are relevant. These include applying innovations in aquaculture. They include investment in research and development. They include improved information and communication flow. And what we've tried to do in the report is to give you an overview of the current and emerging issues and trends related to this, look at the progress with respect to the expectations and commitments of the declaration, and then wind up with some thoughts for the future. So starting with definitions, we had some discussion about this. This is quite normal at the outset of this kind of work. Virtual technology, the way we've interpreted it, is defined as any artificial representation of ecosystems that support aquaculture, whether directly or indirectly. And the idea here is that these representations can help you to measure, to understand, and to predict or to forecast the underlying variables in order to promote and inform an ecosystem approach to aquaculture. And we can distinguish between tools that are related to measurements and then form the platforms for converting data into information. Lots of systems have plenty of data and very little information. And then, as a second part, the modeling tools that then pick up on that information and tailor it for given purposes and support decisions. So there are three of these tables, and I will just cherry-pick a couple of items off them, and you can do the same. The report has got these tables in more extensive form. The point here is that there are a number of issues, and they're fairly wide-ranging, that need to be addressed. Obviously not all of them for particular cases, but these are the main areas that we've identified. So, for instance, for morphology and climate, there are issues with respect to basic physical descriptions and other generic environmental variables. Likewise for water availability, for exchange, things like current velocities. I must say that the majority of the examples I have are focused more on open water aquaculture, and I know that I'm in an area of the world where there's a lot of inland aquaculture, but most of what I'll say is relevant for both, and in fact it's actually easier from the virtual technology side to deal with the more constrained systems that are inland than the open water systems. The movement of water adds a measurable complication to the whole thing. There are two groups of things here on environmental interactions. One is the water quality component, and obviously water quality affects aquaculture and is also affected by it. If you're thinking of organic extractive aquaculture, then components which form part of the food driver, such as organic detritus or chlorophyll, are a particular case in point that need to be addressed properly in order to get models to simulate what's happening in the system adequately. Likewise with environmental interactions, if you look at the EAA concept, things like the extent of SAV, the submerged aquatics, or the wild species in the benthos are components that need attention. The culture practice I'll just touch very briefly on, because when we first started doing this kind of stuff in the early 90s, culture practice used to be regarded as something that was easy to deal with, and we found pretty quickly that it is fairly intractable. There's very little consensus very often on the way things are done, and so you need to pay a lot more attention to it. And I think an example of that is the varying estimates that we've heard through the last few days on the global aquaculture production. The numbers 52 and 68 keep cropping up. There's only a 30% difference there. It's nothing special. Let me just give you some examples, because a talk like this, I think, illustrates better with a series of examples. This is some work from Kapetsky et al., and it illustrates and I mentioned this yesterday in plenary after Gary Jensen's talk, and this highlights the idea that you can use geographic information systems to identify potential areas for offshore aquaculture. What you have here are two layers. This is done through radar using sensors and crossing the current speeds, which are in suitable ranges, with the water depth to identify the potential with respect to various countries. So this is not international waters. And if you crunch these numbers, you can come up with a range of between 10 to the 6 and 10 to the 7 tons per year. So you're talking upwards of $1 billion in terms of revenue. Obviously, this would need additions. If you were looking at co-cultivation of shellfish, you might, for instance, have an HAB risk-based, harmful algal bloom, HAB, HAB, risk-based map and so forth. This is another example. This is Sangubay. Patrick Sourgelos, in his masterclass on Thursday, already showed this slide. This is in Shandong province in northeastern China. They do a diverse range of integrated multi-trophic aquaculture, IMTA. They've got these long lines with droppers with Pacific oyster. They have fish cages. They hang stays across the long lines with Laminaria japonica, so they do seaweeds as well. And they put pens or nets on the bottom with abalone to catch the detritus that's falling down. I think actually it should be called integrated multi-story multi-trophic aquaculture, so because it's a three-floor building, so it would be IMMTA. Anyhow, the culture practice component is fundamental to try and understand how to make simulations work, because it acts as a forcing function to the models. And in this case, this is an image from Google Earth, so anybody can have a look at these structures. In this particular project, which is a project called SPEAR, the Landsat imagery was used, and that helped us map these various zones. It was ground truth with the help of some of the Chinese colleagues. This is a more integrated slide of the various GIS layers that you can have. What is shown here is an area called Xianchanggang in China, in near Ningbo city, so that's about 2 hours south of Shanghai if you're not familiar with the terrain there. And you can see the land cover, you can see the limits of the coastal body, you can see the bathymetry, and these are all superimposed in GIS. This is the bread and butter of modeling. You can see the sampling stations, various other features. The hydrological component, we were speaking yesterday about the EAA aspects with respect to pond culture and how that would determine the loading to the coastal waters. So these systems need to be looked at in integrated coastal zone management, and EAA for me is not really much more than a subsector of that in terms of application. And finally, you can see some of the coastal intertidal aquaculture features. So, types of virtual technology. Some of this comes from an excellent review that John Bostock from the University of Stirling produced, and that's in the Burnell and Allen book that was mentioned by Craig Browdy the other day. It's a really worthwhile book, not cheap, but very worthwhile. And so there are aspects such as the control of production, and there's comments here on technology and scale. One of the points is that a lot of these things can use mathematical models. For optimization of production, for mapping resources and environment, assessing system changes, and so on and so forth. And from the point of view of communication and learning, there is so much out there these days. In the last 5 or 6 years, that has changed dramatically, and I'll speak a bit more on that a little later on. So, These are just some illustrative slides. This is from the SMILE project, which was carried out in Northern Ireland. I have some Caron Beach virtual technology from one of the informal guys. And so this here is an area called Belfast Lough. This is the shelf waters off Ireland. And this is the dividing line between Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland. And what this is an application of a hydrodynamic model. And it's emitting a conservative tracer from Belfast Lough, and it is being dispersed over the period of the year. You can see along the top the year, and you will notice that the water goes into the lough below, which is Strangford Lough, and in September during the higher spring tides, it actually reaches down to the one that forms the division between the two the two countries, which is called Carlingford Lough. And the point here is that you can't treat these systems independently when you come to look at the way they behave from the point of view of aquaculture. In this case, it's polyculture of mussels, Pacific oyster, scallop, native oyster, Ostreagulus, etc. And this is important for at least three reasons. It's important for larval dispersal. It's important with respect to aspects in terms of disease propagation, so it's not just the relaying issues. And obviously it's important as well for xenobiotics. I mean, there's a whole lot of other things that are carried along in terms of heavy metals and so on and so forth with these movements. So we can go from this more complex situation with a very detailed shelf model to the middle pane on this screen, which shows you a zoom-in for Belfast Lough, and then to coarser-scale ecological models such as ECHOIN 2000, which are less detailed on the physics. They take the physics from the more complex models, and they then are able to simulate the processes for a lot more variables and for a lot longer periods. So typically, we'd be simulating the growth of aquaculture for periods of up to 10 years or even more than that, which begins to be the sort of scale that interests people in the socioeconomic component. So part of the trick here is this big division of scales. And you can do things like this with it, and the people who are managing the industry in Northern Ireland are using this kind of thing for decision support. This is a typical law of diminishing returns curve. There are three areas which are called boxes here for the lock. You can see that the blue box is still in the early growth phases of the culture, and so if you increase the seeding density, of, in this case it's blue mussels, it's Mighty deciduous, you can see this along the bottom. There is really no noticeable decrease. But in the green area, which is medium stocking, you already see the typical tailing off of the production function. And the red one, as you get past the standard seeding rate, you are already in an area which is unfavorable from the point of view of farming. And so that's an important thing for decision makers to be aware of. Farmers in that area will not welcome new leases being granted, and the regulators would not encourage them to increase their stocking densities because it would do no good. Obviously, these things all interact as well. You're talking about a system which moves. I'll have to paraphrase my colleague Mike Elliott to tell you that each presentation must have at least one horrendogram, and this is my horrendogram. But it's not that horrendous. It's actually got a fair few boxes. I've seen some other more horrendous ones this week. We have various types of models. This shows you the interactions of them. Species growth models, hydrodynamic models, which I just showed you, catchment models. A lot of this stuff, I think that's important to mention in the context of the talk yesterday, is available open source, free, usually from the US, and we should take much more advantage of that, particularly in developing countries, both with respect to satellite imagery. There's so many resources that the federal government puts online, universities do as well, and I think that's not stressed enough, and we have a lot to be grateful for in that respect. These things end up with ecological models which can be combined with socioeconomic models. If the socioeconomics is 50% of the problem, getting the ecology 100% right will only solve half the issue. So there's not a huge percentage in that. And so the ultimate objective there is to look towards integrated coastal zone management. I'll give you two local scale examples. This one is from Trevor Telfer's group in the University of Stirling. That was also part of the SPEAR project, and it's a very simple representation of what happens underneath a fish cage. It can be done in Excel, so it's the kind of thing that's easy to use, and it's based on patterns of current velocities and on water depth and various other criteria, and it will give you an image of what happens at the level of the sediment in terms of the organic wastes that are falling from the fish cages. Obviously, that has serious repercussions in terms of sediment oxygen demand and the knock-on effects on the biology. This is another example from the farm model applied to Sangu Bay. That's the Chinese bay that I showed you earlier on. And again, I'll cherry-pick off this so I don't spend too much time on the slide. It's divided into the sort of classifications that you saw in Barry Costa-Pierce's talk with environment, economics, the social component. I just called it people, planet, profit, so it's the same thing. If you look at the total physical product, which is the harvestable material, this is again for Pacific oyster. The example A is in monoculture, and example B is oysters and fish in integrated multitrophic aquaculture. You see a huge jump, two orders of magnitude, in the potential production of oysters in the IMTA scenario, and obviously that is coming from the subsidy of organic material, which is, let's say, a byproduct of the fish culture. That reflects in the average physical product, so these are more the words that economists would use when they do things like marginal analysis, and that is the ratio of output over input. So an indicator of ROI, of return on investment, if you like. And you can see that, again, that the return on investment is much higher in the IMTA component. There is a significant top-down effect with respect to eutrophication control. So you've got chlorophyll going from something like, this is the percentile 90, going from 9 micrograms per liter to 6, roughly. I couldn't agree more with Patrick Sorgelos on the idea that if there wasn't this kind of aquaculture activity in China, there would be colossal coastal eutrophication problems at the moment. And I actually think that is a problem to consider in the future, because there are all sorts of conflicts in terms of usage of the coastal zone. And so it remains to be seen whether that's not something that's going to surprise them a few years down the road. And you can equate that top-down control to the nitrogen removal. from the system, you can convert that to population equivalents. And in some parts of the world, for instance, in the Long Island Sound Basin in the east coast of the United States, there are integrated watershed nutrient management programs, which include nutrient trading, so a kind of similar to the carbon trading market. And there's no reason why shellfish farmers should not be able to sell nutrient credits for the ecosystem service they provide and have those competing with the people from the agricultural sector who may need to offset some of their emissions rather than control them at source. And obviously there are consequences with respect to this, both on the income from the product side and on the income from the services side, if that service market is developed. Okay, let me talk to you a little bit about the novel management component of the review and give you some of the case study examples. So there are three areas here that I've highlighted. One is the feed-based component, the second is shellfish farming, and the third is integrated multitrophic aquaculture. And at the moment, although there's a fair bit of modeling work going on, it's still a little bit ivory tower, and I'll get to that in the reflections later on. Site selection based on holding capacity for cages, on minimizing wastewater for ponds, but there's very little calculation of the negative externalities that come from that. So the environment and indirectly all of us pay in a secondary way. And there's a big tradition of that kind of thing from the days of the PCB stories from the Great Lakes in the US and various things like that. So it's a knock-on effect. This is tomorrow, 10 years from now perhaps, 5-10 years, gives you some of the ideas of the kinds of models, the kinds of tools which in many cases use computers and computing to be able to address this better. The shellfish farming component occupies large areas typically. The focus in terms of estimates of carrying capacity are largely on production and on social carrying capacity. And on the social thing, you've got one well-known buzzword, this not invented, not in my backyard buzzword, and one more recent one, which is a more political one, which is not in my term in office. Things will change in time with respect to that as well as we get better capacity to model what's going on. On the IMTA front, everybody highlights what good things are coming from that, but it's not getting that quantitative. We didn't see too much on the quantitative side at the meeting here. And if we didn't see it here, we probably wouldn't see it anywhere. And I can easily see things moving towards a more analytical approach where we can actually cost through those benefits and see what differences they actually make. And there's an awful lot that you can do with GIS, with remote sensing, and again with dynamic models. So just a few examples, and I'm sorry to be a bit fast with them, but it's a time issue. This is from John Grant from Dalhousie University. It's a very simple box model. On the left-hand side, you've got the Atlantic Ocean, and this is in Tracadie Bay in Prince Edward Island. And what's happening is that there is water that transports the food supply for shellfish. In this case, it's for blue mussel, which goes into the bay from the bay mouth on the left up to the bay head. What you see on the y-axis is the percentage of the boundary chlorophyll. In other words, it's a proxy for the food supply. And what happens to it in these various compartments as you go upstream into the bay. And you can see that with 1,000-ton stocking, and as I say, this is a very simple model, and these things are pretty useful even at this simple level. There's no need to make things complicated unless it's absolutely necessary. You can see that for the 1,000-ton stocking, the mussels are actually enhancing productivity in the bay. Increasing the turnover of nutrients and so forth. And that's actually, from my perspective, a positive thing. You can also see that as you increase the stocking, you are clearly exceeding the carrying capacity of the bay. And when you get to the red zone at 4,000 tons, if you go upstream to box 5, it doesn't seem to be a particularly interesting thing to be doing shellfish there anymore because they don't get any food. Completely different example from my colleague Øyvind Strand from IMR in Bergen. The Norwegians are doing some terrific work in various areas of aquaculture, and that includes the information technology areas. This is a kind of traffic light representation of site selection for aquaculture using GIS, using geographic information systems. And you have here both fish cages, there would be salmon there, and also, I would say, predominantly blue mussel. And it takes into account, it's got three modules. I can't read this in detail, and so this is all detailed in the report, but it's got three modules, and they look at components such as the legislation, what are the input sources from land, what is the proximity of other types of aquaculture, and in the end you get a traffic light thing with a green or a yellow or a red, which gives you some handle on whether that would be suitable for a new venture. This is some other work that's being done by people at IMR. It's completely different. Again, it's called the welfare meter, and the idea, it's what we'd call a data simulation or operational model. And the idea here is that you have these cages. They can have upwards of $1 million US dollars of fish. They are submerged at some depth, so it's not obvious that you can see how well the fish are doing. And they have these CTD devices or CTD-like devices that are moving up and down through the cage at particular intervals with sensors, and more sensors are coming online, as you know. This instrumentation is sending information to a database, and that in turn is used for decision support by means of models that use expert system approaches to look at fish behavior and water quality constituents, etc. So farmers get on the web and look at these things in real time. So it's a way of paying attention to the culture that was mentioned, I don't think in exactly these words, in a previous presentation. And there are similar systems being developed in other parts. There's some guys in Slovenia doing a similar kind of work for the bass and bream. This is some other work that we've been playing around with respect to a land-based culture of shrimp. There are a number of models like this around already, but this is looking at not only the feed application, the food eaten and so forth, but we're using individual models of shrimp growth, which then translate into population dynamics models. And then at the bottom, we're using some actually relatively old stuff from DiToro et al. To do the diagenesis components and the nutrient regeneration so that we can model the primary production, we can put in the aerators, the oxygen component, and we can also simulate water exchange into and out of the ponds. And therefore, we can calculate a mass balance and calculate the negative externalities of a particular culture cycle. Okay, so I'm getting to the final leg of this. Key recommendations. I'm going to be putting this slide up again when the people that we've invited to come up and sit for the discussion, sit up here for the discussion, then come up. That will help focus the discussion. So there are a number of things here that I would stress, six in total. Innovations to drive aquaculture as virtual technologies become more widespread and aquaculture becomes increasingly competitive. Information exchange and networking will accelerate the use of virtual technology. You see this all the time. Happens in every discipline. There's no reason why it shouldn't be happening in aquaculture, and it will. Web-based access to real information will also accelerate this growth. The links between industry and research need to be more effective. This isn't as good as it should be, to create objective-led demands, again, to get out of this ivory tower thing. And we need strengthening of collaboration between developed countries and between developed and developing countries, and that will be done mainly through educational and training programs. There need to be strategic alliances for implementation of virtual technology, so there is an understanding and a communication, and the gaps are not widened. The virtual technology tools need to be more production-oriented and management-oriented, and they need to be adapted to local realities and conditions, and that, again, is often not understood. Let's talk a little bit about the way forward. Particularly at this forum, aquaculture has special importance for developing countries. Healthy food, money. Which developing countries should be priorities? These are very difficult questions. We had some discussions about this. One way to look at it is look at the ecosystem approach to aquaculture and say where there is most impact on the environment, that should definitely be one of the places where tools like this have a significant role to play. Which tools? That depends on species and culture systems. So there's no silver bullets, and that's also an important message. With respect to models, I'm very humble about models. And the dissemination question is important as well. Is it passive? Do people just download and then have to figure everything out, which is complicated? Is it active, which has got a totally different cost with respect to extension and teaching and so forth? Some emerging issues that we flagged. Some of these can be better addressed with virtual technologies. Some cannot. disease at the moment. We're still pretty much at the Robert May stage with the SIR or SIR model, for which it's essentially probability-driven. The risk assessment components, which are, I think, improving and getting more into the virtual side. And John Bostock, who looked at this paper in a sort of interim review, suggested also that the coming online of Sentinel Fish with the miniaturization of sensors, so guys were wandering around checking on their brothers and sisters. I don't know too much about that, but it seems like a cool idea, and it would be an interesting thing to see developing. Harmful algal blooms are an area of huge importance. They're important all over Southeast Asia. They're important in my country, in the Iberian Peninsula. Very often these things are upwelled from offshore, so there isn't anything you can do to actually control them. But what you can do is have a better handle operationally on how to interdict and how to defend the farmers and the community and the food safety components. There are improvements on the biotech side to be coming for sure, and also remote sensing, which is pretty far behind on that, needs to improve with respect to algorithms that can discriminate between harmful algae and others. Certification and traceability, we've already talked about in the context of various other talks, including the previous one, and sensor arrays can help with that. You can have a barcoding process for monitoring and certification where you have a cradle-to-grave record of what your shellfish or what your fish went through during its period in cultivation. And that could include aspects to do with feeding. It could include aspects to do with harmful algal blooms, oxygen lows, and so on and so forth. So the consumer can be informed, perhaps in more detail than they would like to be informed. That's another question. A very important thing in my mind for the developing country community is modeling with data scarcity. In the West, and that is reflected sometimes in the approach to looking at how journal papers are received, there is a concern that there has to be an appropriate and extensive amount of data to be able to drive some of this stuff. And in some cases in the developing world, the data is not necessarily all appropriate, and there isn't that much of it. So we can resort, as I said, to lots of the remote tools that are available, made available, for instance, by the US, and hopefully more and more by other countries as well. But it is important to understand that given that the expansion of aquaculture is going to take place in the developing countries, it's not going to take place in Europe, and it's not going to take place in the U.S. We heard Paul Olin talk about a growth of a further 1 million tons in the U.S. That's not going to be more than a blip on the radar. So it's very important that this modeling activity and the access to data and the promotion of the use of more diverse data sources is carried out, and that modeling with data scarcity is considered, obviously taking into account the losses that you have in terms of accuracy, so therefore the uncertainty. Progress in information technology. Web 2.0, I think everybody sort of below my age has got Facebook accounts. I don't tweet yet, but I've learnt to expect the unexpected. So Web 2.0 is definitely among us. On YouTube, if you typed in aquaculture in May when we were finalizing this work, you got about 1,800 hits. Now, September, you get 4,800. Annualized growth, 750%. If you type in aquaculture modeling, you got 20 hits. Now, 132. 2,000%. A lot of it's rubbish. We know that. Google University accounts for a lot of the hardships that we have, those of us who are in the teaching profession. But nevertheless, some of it is good, and it'll get better. It'll find its own process of triage. We need to be optimistic about it. Software as a service, SaaS. Google Apps, as you probably know, is giving Microsoft a really hard time with respect to the use of things like Excel and Word, this whole idea that you go onto the web and you solve your problems there rather than having something on your computer that you have to install and so on and so forth. Farm, this model that I mentioned to you, a simplified version of that runs online. There's no reason that we can't do some of that. One of the issues there is the business model, obviously, and I'll talk about that in my last slide, which is just coming. So I just wanted to finish with this. It's an image actually from my cell phone from 2008 when I was in China. This is south of Guangzhou, down the Pearl River, in an island called Haiyu Island. It means seagull island. And there's a large tilapia farm that you can see in the center there. So mobile computing is becoming increasingly ubiquitous. right from Professor Swaminathan's picture of the fisherman with the cell phone and looking for the wave heights and various other things, that set the scene for that. Standalone servers are disappearing. Now it's somewhere that I don't know, but it's called the cloud. But I don't really care as long as I get back what I need from wherever it is. For me, it's just a black box somewhere. And so all that stuff is completely and radically changing the way we should look at these things. And aquaculture has got all sorts of side benefits on that. Data circulation is much easier, much faster, and much cheaper. Even in Portugal, when I started work there, we were severely limited with respect to access to bibliography because we have poor quality libraries. Nowadays, we're all on a level playing field with that. And that is fantastic, absolutely fantastic. In the last 20 years, it's been a complete revolution. We need to define workable business models. This came up in the biotech area. There needs to be mechanisms by which this stuff is transferred, and we need to work out how it's paid for. It may be paid upstream through research projects that are funded, for instance, through the EU or from some of the other international agencies that do that, but it's something that needs thought. But I do think that mobile computing will help bridge the gap between richer and poorer nations in access to information technology. So some years ago, I used to say thanks for your attention, but now I'm growing older, and so I put a premium on time. So thanks very much for your time.
Thank you very much, Ferreira, for your good presentation. I wish to call upon the panelists, please, to come up. I understand majority of the panelists are not here, but we have friends of the panelists.
I have the pleasure of briefly mentioning my colleagues' names, and they've kindly agreed to join us because, like we said, most of our panel members, unfortunately, were not able to come. But I'm sure that our colleagues as experts in this field can also support us in polishing some of the recommendations. So Patrick Sorhelos, Barry Costa-Pierce, Patrick White, Chocho, if I may pronounce it, Dr. Kokarkin. Yes. Welcome. And myself, of course, Pepe Aguilar from FAO. Thank you very much.
Thank you. We'll now take some questions so that we can have some discussions. And I'm requesting that please direct your questions towards some form of recommendation so that we can come up with the recommendations at the end of this presentation. Thank you. Any questions, please?
No, thanks. Thanks very much to the presenter and the panel. I think these are fantastic technologies, and I was just wondering, is anyone from the industry using them? Are there some examples from maybe this region where aquaculture is so important, where these kind of technologies are being used daily? Thanks very much.
Other people probably will have something to say about that. In this region, I know that some of the work that was done in China is being used. I don't know if it's on a daily basis, but it's certainly been used to look at different scenarios for changing stocking densities and culture combinations in some of the systems. But this kind of modeling work, I like to say that it works by infection, so it's a contagious process. First people start thinking, I've got a little bit of a cold, and then suddenly they've got the flu with it, and they understand that it's very important. And that happens also with the GIS and so on and so forth. Certainly in the GIS area, there will be lots of people using different types of tools. I don't know if you...
From my viewpoint, and maybe my other colleagues can mention, but my viewpoint, there's about five or six countries that are already using this technology, and specifically GIS and remote sensing, and that is mainly Canada, Norway, Spain, Thailand, and Brazil. All of them have already online systems to be able to perhaps look at sighting and zoning. So they're actually using it for decision-making. All that information is already on a website that FAO has just released. It's called the National Aquaculture Sector Overview Map Collection, and it has a section there that provides links to these examples that I just mentioned. So it's currently being used for actual decision-making.
There was an effort about 5 years ago through ICES, the International Council for the Exploration of the Sea, on carrying capacity. It was a real seminal meeting about 3 years ago in Halifax, Nova Scotia, where the shellfish people developing carrying capacity models and mostly mass balance models, sort of led by the New Zealanders and then disseminated throughout the ICES region. On the east coast of the United States, our lab group has been working with the Kiwis to develop their carrying capacity models to the next step. So in press right now are a number of these ecopath decision-making models with some of my students. But they're taking it. There's another group in the Marine Affairs Department who's been working, again, with that group to take it to the next step and look at social carrying capacity models, with the idea that social carrying capacity drives the ecological carrying capacity. So what we found is, obviously, the ecological carrying capacity for many of our lagoons and shallow seas is quite higher than the permitted levels for shellfish aquaculture development, but that we're constrained by the riparian landowners and the multiple user conflicts. So when we go back to the social processes that we have ongoing, and we share those ecological carrying capacities with not only the riparian landowners, but also with the regulators, then we bring in the public and obviously bring down or reconnoiter the social carrying capacity to a much lower level.
Maybe another additional information. I'm not really involved in this sort of technology, but my department really involved in this one. It's involving the Sydney University, Hasanuddin University, and MMF in South Sulawesi. The farmers, actually, they are not really involved in this making, but they are being asked for what is the output of this mapping. And after we made some topography and water supply and productivity, and then they realized that there are some creek that never the water never flowed to the sea, so it's just written when the tide rising, something like that. And then they know that this is not a productive area, so they shift from shrimp into the milkfish. And then the group decide what to do with the canal, and they decide this canal should become a sedimentation canal, and in this side they have to raise the seaweed and mangrove area, and the dumping site is the NIPA or the acid sulfate soil land. So the decision can be made by the farmers if they involve from what is the outcome would be.
Thank you, Betty. Well, I really say the word awesome what I've owed by the presentation, Dr. Ferreira, and the prospect of this. You talk about emerging issues, but there is one persistent issue that I think you provided a caveat for in your talk, which is the preferences of decision makers, and that's usually difficult to factor into modeling. Mm-hmm. I would suggest that probably in the recommendations or the way forward, you bring in the welfare economist into the team much closer than probably what you are doing now. Thank you.
Thank you. Now that's a good suggestion. I agree.
I'm Pali Amar Singh from Sri Lanka. So I just want to report here that in Sri Lanka, you know, we have used these search or technology tools, you know, GIS and remote sensing, together with multi-criteria decision-making tools to select suitable sites for cultivated fisheries in freshwater reservoirs. Thank you.
I have a question and information to the audience. We in India have used remote sensing and GIS to show that the impact of shrimp farming on mangroves is not as it has been painted. Because what happens is that because of what has happened in some countries, it is sort of superimposed on all other countries. And it's said for all over the world that shrimp farming is damaging mangroves. But using remote sensing and ground truth, we have been able to show that that has not been the case. So this is just for information. The second is that pond-based sensors, the cost is coming down very, very rapidly. And I seem to see that the industry seems to be using it much more effectively. What about research institutes to ensure that enhancing productivity, or for little understood, less studied phenomena like the soil-water interface or the diurnal cycles. Are there any studies going on that you are aware of? Because you had a very comprehensive presentation, but pond-based sensors you made a mention, but did not go deeper into that.
I am not up on the detail of sensor development, so I can't address that. I am pretty sure that all sorts of things are going on because it is really a fast growth area in so many different things. I mean, as a stupid example, we have to look at is what cars have inside now compared to what they had 10 years ago. It's absolutely ridiculous. My car at the moment has no dipstick. I was very surprised by that. It shows how old I am. But I can't give you any specific answers on that. What I can say, though, perhaps Pep would comment on that, is with respect to the mangrove aspects in GIS because of some of the things that we saw in Nicaragua. That big impacts there with respect to the mangrove. Do you want to comment on that?
There's a lot of archives already from the past from Landsat. I don't want to go into too technical details, but there's a huge amount of information, and Joao already mentioned to you. But there's countries like Nicaragua that are already looking at the impacts of shrimp farming on the mangroves. So there's a tremendous amount of satellite imagery that has been created in the past, and new satellite imagery that is now easily available. So a lot of the impediments that we had in the past for both accessing that data and getting it processed are now no longer an impediment. There's a huge number of countries already being able to get hold of that data to be able to better assess the impacts that we have had on the mangroves. There's also an initiative on conducting an inventory of mangroves worldwide. The Worldwide Fund for Nature has already created a global inventory on mangroves. And FAO, not our department, but another department in FAO, Natural Resources Department, is also involved in contributing to this global inventory on mangroves. And that's something that is also available through the Internet. So both at a global scale and at a more localized scale, you can get hold of this information to be able to assess the impacts over time.
Bakhtiyor Karimov from Uzbekistan. We have developed during 2003-2005 database on hydrological, hydrobiological, and hydrochemical indicators of aquatic ecosystems in Uzbekistan, Aral Sea Basin. Based on ArcView GIS 3.2 system, you are right. The main problem was the quality of data what we could collect during this work. Therefore, we had to organize a few expeditions, field expeditions, in order to collect more realistic data on hydrological, hydrobiological indicators of our aquatic ecosystems. But the main problem was when we presented the developed GIS base to our authorities, they had no or very little number of specialists who understand this program and who can use the developed GIS system. This is still for us, I think for all Central Asian countries or maybe for other countries, the main problem, using developed GIS systems or databases. Therefore, I think we should pay more attention in direction to educate local decision makers, even decision makers, how to use this program. Most of them even doesn't have this program because it costs also, they are also enough expensive programs.
You know? Okay, thank you. I'll get Patrick Sojalos maybe to make a call.
Yeah, very good point, Dr. Karimov. Indeed, as is mentioned in one of the recommendations, collaboration and especially training programs. That's where there might be a big difference between the tools that are available and the difficulty to access it or apply it in developing countries. So I think you give support for that recommendation.
If I could tie it also with our colleague who mentioned about sensor development. So Joe mentioned not only is there freeware available, that is sort of off the shelf and available. But what is kind of extraordinary, if you look at the ocean, the marine and the ocean engineering field, the sort of off-the-shelf sensors, the coming down in price of thermistors that have long-term memory, it can plug, you know, right into a laptop, as one example, and many, many other examples coming from the ocean engineering field of low-cost sensors for field monitoring. So I'd like to sort of maybe if we could massage our recommendation a little bit, is sort of making that more accessible and the knowledge of those new sensors and putting it into sort of those training packages along with freeware available.
I just wish to underscore the importance of looking broader in the sense that there's a lot of data and tools that are being developed for other sectors, especially in this field, virtual tools, and explicitly in the field of GIS, in the sense that there are other sectors that are efficiently, accurately using information, and we could partner with these other sectors to be able to gain in training and to be able to share data. I, for example, in FAO, have a lot of work that is done with my colleague from Capture Fisheries, and of course, looking at into mariculture and marine capture fisheries, there's a tremendous advantage in, you know, teaming up and sharing information and data between the two of us. So I think we should also look into other sectors that are using these tools.
Thank you. I think I'll just take more questions, and please, very short to the point, but I specifically want to, there are two hands, Doris and one gentleman here, please. Short to the point, because of time.
Perhaps a recommendation for many people, especially in developing countries, these technologies are magic. And very often the people in the ground don't believe the data they see. And Pepe mentioned the case in Nicaragua, and of course they see the maps, but they don't believe the way the information is collected on ground. So I think it's very important to make sure that the ground truthing is transparent and participatory, so people see this information as representing the reality. And when the information is not available, we need to make sure that when we work with few data, people understand that we are doing something in a transparent and objective way.
If I may, I cannot fully agree more with you. And in that regard, in addition to that, also all the decision-making simulations that are done with GIS, we make them to be as participatory as possible to be able to engage those people into the decision-making process that we make using these tools.
No, it's data is a problem, and often you have to go into the field to try and get that data, particularly current measurements, water quality measurements, and this is expensive. Modeling can take some of that place, particularly for current predictions and wave height predictions. But using that data to then make decisions for siting of aquaculture, for carrying capacity of different areas is very important. But one of the main problems is the data and the real data at ground truth data.
My name is Linson Yang from China. Dr. Ferreira, in your presentation, you gave a number of examples from China. If I want to take a more detailed look, where can I get the information?
I apologize for not having put up enough website information. I also tried to get the talk distributed, but you've already heard the reasons why it's not being distributed at the moment. Otherwise, it would have already been on a website. There is a website at biaoqiangspear.org, which has got a book that we published at the time, and I can speak to you at coffee and tell you a bit more about that because it's not of general interest. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you, panelists, for the good discussions. Thank you to you all for your questions. We have eaten into the tea break, So I think we'll have 20 minutes for tea. We'll be back at 1:45 so that we are back on track with the time for the next presentation. And thank you very much for your questions and to the panelists.